a lot of hating going on. You pop a cherry with an orgy and it's all good.
Really, really talented, handsome young man.
Don't walk in here with a giant banana and think everything's going to be peaches.
Welcome to the Alligator Sports Podcast on Tuesday, May 24th. I'm host Jesse Simonton filling in for Adam Berry. Little Jay Leno, Johnny Carson thing going on. Got three esteemed Alligator writers here. John Booth. You want to say something, Johnny?
Yeah.
Brian Holt.
How's it going, everybody?
And Matty Watts.
Yep, yep.
Three first-timers today on the podcast, so we're just going to talk a little Gator sports, what happened during the weekend, the craziness that was. Started off right away with some craziness, Gator softball. What happened there, Holtie?
Basically the greatest weekend of Gators women's softball ever. I've been trying to decide the last couple days if Florida and UCLA really almost fought or if I was just hoping they would fight so much that it kind of embraced into my mind that they were about to. But basically, a lot of hit batters, a lot of craziness. Saw a total of 9 hit batters in 2 games on Sunday. 3 in game 1, 6 in game 2, actually game 7 of the series. Ended up being, 3 for each side. And after Bruder got hit in the third inning, they called warnings to both dugouts, which from everybody around, nobody had ever seen dugouts get worn in softball before. It was pretty crazy. UCLA's coach went off during the game. She went off after the game. Pretty much called Hannah Rogers' actions inexcusable, called Walton inexcusable, called everyone at the University of Florida pretty much inexcusable and dirty. So Walton kept it pretty clean in his response, didn't dig too much into it, just kind of...
Sounds like he was coy a little bit with some of the stuff he said, or it's kind of like backhanded, like, well, it's UCLA for Pete's sake or whatever.
Yeah.
She was nervous or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. He brought up that she had made the same allegations against Stacey Nelson last couple of years when she was pitching against them. And, it's UCLA. It's one of the biggest programs. It's the biggest program in college softball. They're a little bit down this year, but they've won 11 national championships. And
didn't they hang a bunch of runs on Florida last year in the World Series?
Yeah, 16-3 was the final in last year's College World Series. And that was one of Walton's points. He said, you know what? Nobody was crying for us at the hotel last year when we lost 16-3. And I was looking at some of the pictures and videos from that game today, and Andrea Harrison, who was in defense mode yesterday, was just giving it to him. There was a scene where I think she had a blast, and she's like pointing at the Gators dugout running home. And so it's kind of rare, in softball, all these girls grow up playing together and all that kind of stuff. And usually the teams are very, cordial and all that. And these are two teams that just really don't seem to like each other.
How much does it have to do with it that a lot of Florida stars are from California?
I think it has a decent amount to do with it. I don't know if it's completely that. Because
who are some of those people? Coyle's one of them.
Coyle, Bruder, Megan Bush, Asia Pakulba, Ensley Gamble, and Brittany Schutte are all from Southern California. It's a little bit of a tough one because most of those girls were recruited by UCLA, so it's not like they're using the motivation that, hey, UCLA shut us down. I mean, we were talking about it yesterday. Coyle, her recruitment came down to UCLA in Florida, and so she obviously picked Florida for whatever reason, even though she'd grown up cheering for UCLA. So I don't know if it's a matter of, oh, we're from Southern California and grew up, UCLA fans, and they didn't pick us, because most of these girls were recruited by UCLA, but it obviously has something to do with it,
I mean, it's crazy. This rivalry is really starting to bud. It's weird that they would put UCLA all the way from California in a Gainesville regional. You know what I mean? I mean, obviously the records, they were kind of down last year, but it's a defending national champion, and then the number 4 overall seed in the entire tournament. You put them together in the same bracket when they've got that history from last year. And then it even, it escalated, I think, in the first game on Sunday when Grace Murray, infamous UCLA Bruin third string catcher, I think leaned into one, probably on Coach Perez's instructions in the fifth inning. And then that kind of started the barrage of the hit batman. And, that Grace Murray situation is another interesting thing that happened this weekend.
It was a hell of an intro softball weekend for you there, Watson.
Yeah, I mean, for
Watson, me. Had been to a softball game before and had to go cover it for a different news outlet and had a hell of a time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sitting there in the best press row.
Reinhold press row at Chrysler Stadium.
Yeah, it was quite an interesting debut softball experience for me. But back to the Grace Murray thing, UCLA, is this added to the whole contentious weekend between UCLA and Florida? In their first game that they played on Saturday, was it the first or second inning? Their original catcher was out like before the series. Inning, yeah. But their backup catcher got injured in the second inning on a double play ball. Aja Pakuba tags her out and she injures her knee. So then Grace Murray, the third string catcher, who is a senior who had never appeared in a game as a defensive player or had an at bat in her 4-year career, was solely a pinch runner, comes in and
pulled
has
her
to
off
be
the track team.
Yeah, pulled her off the track team or out of the bullpen as Perez says to be the catcher. And the Gators, let's see, they stole 7 bases in the first game on Sunday and 9 bases, including 6 in the first inning on Sunday.
Coyle doubled her season total against the Bruins.
I mean, this is Gators softball. This is a team that's, you know, wait for a 3-run blast. It's not like these girls have been stealing bases at all year. I don't know if Megan pushes
the Bobby Cox. Homer or nothing.
And yeah, like I said, he was trying to be coy, you know, after the first game on Saturday, saying, oh, we're not trying to take advantage of her. That's always our strategy coming in. We want to be aggressive on the base paths. We're going to have to manufacture runs in the postseason. But then,
on day two.
After Coach Perez had her little outs in the press conference, Walton said, yeah, you saw this girl throw too, didn't you? It was bad. You almost felt sorry for the girl because there was just no chance. Even Megan Bush, 0 stolen bases for the entire year.
0 attempts.
0 even attempts grabbed a stolen base against this girl.
Standing up. What was the – and I have never been to a Florida softball game. I've seen a lot of them on TV and whatnot, but I've never – and the crowds always seem lively. But how were the crowds in these games when it was obviously a very contentious, you know – environment, and the teams are obviously jarring at each other across the dugouts and stuff. So, like, what obviously it's a pro Gator crowd, but how amped up was the crowd for this?
The crowd was definitely amped up for it, especially game one. It was, you could tell the heat got to them a little bit, and a lot of the crowd filed out and actually wasn't at game 7. So that was a little bit weird. Their season's on the line after a huge regular season, and the stands were probably at least half empty for.
Well, it seemed like that at the beginning, but it filled out.
It did fill out.
I mean, but either way, these softball fans are passionate. Let me tell you, they rise and you know they ride the ebb and flow of the game like no other. I mean, they know what's going on. They give the umps some serious flack. I mean, these fans, they're there for sure.
And if you paid attention to it at the first game on the walk-off, Harrison crossed the plate, and the first thing she did before celebrating with any of her teammates was she spiked her helmet and yelled at the crowd. So there was definitely some stuff going on back
Harrison
and forth in the
like
crowd.
Harrison sounds like freaking Banff.
That is exactly how I would describe it.
Harrison character.
She was wilding all weekend.
Her.
My technical term, wilding. She had a line drive game-winning shot against JU in UCLA's first game on Friday. She was raking all weekend. I mean, it's not a surprise. And she actually had a quote after in the post game on Sunday. Said, "That's the only way you're going to either get me out, is, or I'm not going to get a hit, is if you walk me or hit me. So go ahead."
And she said something like, I give Rogers credit for the job she did today, but if I face them again, it's on. I want 11 of those on my team. If you're building a team, you want 11 of those.
What about Bruder's interaction when she got hit by her second, the second time she held up her fingers?
Is that as close to like charging the mound as they'll get in softball?
That was pretty much Bruder's reaction. Actually, when I watched it live, I thought she was a little bit more amped up than she actually was. I went back and watched the 6 hit batters to see what I thought was intentional, what wasn't on ESPN3. And she really was more kind of just – like almost sarcastic or things like that. Like, you know, you hit me twice. That was twice. That was her thing, was that's 2. And honestly, from the crowd at first, I thought it looked a little bit more like she was really saying something to the girl, really. But honestly, I thought Harrison's response to getting hit in the first inning was a little bit more dramatic. I mean, she had a pretty intense stare down with Rogers and tossed her bat.
And in a moment, I mean, none of us have any rooting interest in this. We've said this a gajillion times on the Alligator, but we honestly could care if the Florida wins or loses. We're there to cover the game. We want to see a good game. So this is great, you know, fodder for us. But in, you know, a moment of objectivity, Rodgers has, earlier this season, already been suspended for hitting a batter. So there is some sort of precedent there. I'm not saying that it, obviously UCLA's coach took it to another level, but there is something there with Roger drilling other teams' best batters.
Right, that's what Perez said. She's like, Rodgers is a really, really good pitcher, albeit she's a freshman. She's amazing. Yeah. She has control over her pitches. Walton tried to deny that. You know, she said she didn't have her harness of her curveball. She's facing UCLA. But, I mean, to see the umpires, you know, you see it sometimes in baseball, heated rivalries. The umpire will run out in front of the batter and walk him kind of down to first base to in between the pitcher and that runner. And I've never seen anything like that in softball. And it happened at least 3 or 4 times. And it was just weird to watch. But it was, you know, the whole series was crazy because Florida came into that first game on Sunday with all the momentum, thinking, you know, they were 2-0. You know, we can just run through this game real quick and advance, knock UCLA out. Well, that didn't happen. Donna Kerr one-hit the Gators. You know, they scored 2 runs in the bottom of the 6th off a sack fly and an error. Like, they left 6 runners in scoring position. They didn't do anything at all in the first game. But what they did do was work the count a lot on Donna Kerr. She threw over 120 pitches, and she
got tired.
Yeah, she was done in the third inning of the second game.
It's kind of surprising that UCLA didn't have another arm to go to.
Well, they had
such a deep program and, you know, history and that kind of stuff.
That was kind of what I was thinking sitting there watching. You know, they had, I mean, most teams don't have 3-4 arms sitting around like they do, but none of them really seemed to be any kind of compliment to Kerr at all. I mean, you had Macon who had a wild pitch on an intentional walk attempt on Saturday. So I think that tells us just about all we need to know about her. Hall was a little bit more respectable.
But they didn't go to Hall in the second game until, what was it, the fifth inning, I think? They had 3 pitchers to get through the first, where Florida put up 9 runs.
They used 3 pitchers on 1 out in the first inning.
Yeah.
They were on their 3rd pitcher with 1 out. And, you know, we're up there making jokes about, oh, Gators matched their hit total after Moultrie's single to lead off. Gators passed their hit total. And then the next thing we're looking down at our stat sheet, and it's like, oh, 9 hits and 9 runs and 7 hits in this inning. Man. Like,
almost filled up an entire page, like, just writing down everything that happened, keeping track of all my stats and everything. It was
just
wild.
Just such a giant contrast from one game to another.
Well, I can only hope that there's this much excitement as I head to Hoover in the coming hours. I got to leave in the wee hours of the morning.
Yeah, baseball tournament starts this weekend, right? When are you heading up there?
Tomorrow, early tomorrow morning, unfortunately. But long-ass drive, to say the least. But, yeah, Florida baseball. Florida softball obviously had a heck of a weekend. Florida baseball, they captured back-to-back. Or captured a share of the conference title again. They won 2 out of 3 against Kentucky. It was definitely an interesting series, to say the least. Been an interesting 2 weeks for Florida. They've allowed 3, you know, lacrosse-like scores. You know, 13-3, 14-1.
Yeah, that's crazy.
19-3. I mean, these really bizarre scores that they've been in these lopsided games, and 3 times they've actually lost these games. And all 3 times they came back and won a big conference game, and Kentucky just whooped the snot out of them on Friday night, 14-1, and Florida came back and won 19-3 and captured the share of the conference title. This has been a crazy season. I know you've. I saw you at one of the games the other day. Obviously, you know, follow the team a little bit. I know Watsy knows what's going on. What do you guys think of this team and, like, looking into Hoover and kind of going forward? What do you guys think about them?
For me, I mean, I just don't see it mentally. They've got every bit of physical talent you could need to field, you know, a championship-winning baseball program. But like most sports teams, players adapt their coach's mentality. You know what I mean? And like we were talking about the other day, Sully just kind of seems to micromanage. He worries about a lot of things that, you know, you can't really have control over. And you go back to, like, their midweek struggles. After the huge series against Vanderbilt, right?
Yeah.
They take 2 out of 3 against Vanderbilt, and they come home, and they lose, get just
14-1 against JU.
Yeah, against JU, just demolished. Like, that, I mean, obviously it's not that much a big of a game, but it says something about them. You know, they're, what, 6-6 or 7-7?
7-7, yeah. They have the biggest, one of the biggest issues with this team is that on a given night, you don't know what's going on between their ears. You just don't. They have showed tremendous resolve. The most impressive thing is they'll get smacked around on these midweek games, and then they'll turn around and win the next night. So they have showed good resolve, but the consistency there, that's just been lacking. And a big part of it is Sully is just so high-strung and so wound tight, and everything is such a big deal at that moment. Everything is such a big deal at that moment that it goes off onto the players. I mean, the players are a product of the coach.
Yeah, exactly.
And when your coach is so almost hypersensitive and defensive to even the most minute questions or little things, it definitely rubs off on the guys. And they have they've been like that all season. I mean, they have article that came out today that I wrote was about, you know, Sully finally admitted that this season has been a trying season. That, you know, and the article is kind of funny, and I was talking about it on the radio. It almost looks like the season's over because of what he said. You know, like, it's been such a grind. It's been such a trying season. It's like, well, the biggest part of your season hadn't even happened yet. Yeah. But it is good that he admitted that, like, the pressure of beating number one and the burden of these, you know, budding expectations over and over and over did get to the team, and that for him to finally admit that, I actually thought it was a big thing for him to finally admit that. He's been, you know, kind of been in, like, steadfast denials that pressure means nothing and this, that, and he even, you know, haven't alluded to it yet, but Sully and I kind of had a interesting exchange when he kind of blew up on me when I asked him a question about the pressure after they lost Friday night. And, you know, at least the next day, part of it was this, you know, kind of ecstasy and euphoria they were in because they had just won a conference title, but he at least gave us a moment of honesty that I thought was really refreshing and really kind of gave it a point of reference for the whole season.
I've heard a little bit vaguely about that blow. Can you just elaborate on it a little bit?
Well, basically, I mean, it was Sully was surly.
Well, I mean, you got three teams fighting all for an SEC championship. You know, the final weekend. You got Vanderbilt.
Yeah, set it up like that. Yeah.
Vanderbilt, Florida, and
South Carolina.
And South Carolina all fighting for the championship. You know what I mean? Kentucky comes in and just absolutely throttles Florida 14-1 on Friday, right?
Well, the biggest thing was three. The SEC is dominant this year. I mean, they got three teams in the top five.
That's another
five.
Thing about their expectations. You've got Vanderbilt, South Carolina, both in the Southeastern Conference, in your division, and teams like Virginia and Texas and all these other schools that are amazing, and you've got Florida is expected to just go out and win.
Right.
You know, they're expected to beat these teams, but that's the air of sports in Florida.
Yeah,
and anything,
when much,
you know,
is given, much is to be expected. And that's kind of my thing with Sully, was that, you know, you guys are pimping that you guys have, you know, this tremendous talent, this awesome team, and they absolutely do. I mean, Florida, player for player, is probably as talented as almost any team in the country.
No doubt.
But the thing that happened with Sully was Thursday night, Florida had, after getting, you know, their butts kicked against JU, they come back Thursday night, turn around and win a, you know, dramatic game. They were down, come back.
Zunino,
you know,
Mr. Player of the Year,
Player of the Year today.
Mr. May.
Yeah. He axed another one, and they win. On the same night, number one South Carolina and number three Vanderbilt lose. And so Florida then is a game up with two to play. So if they win Friday night, they automatically share a clinch then. And they put all the pressure on the other two teams. Take that into consideration. Take also into consideration, Florida had to face Alex Meyer. Alex Meyer's Kentucky's horse. He's going to be drafted in the top 20 of June's draft. And Sully has already been displeased with me, and not just me, but other people that have kind of pointed out that Florida this year has struggled mightily against teams' best guns.
Can't beat Sonny Gray.
I mean, they got really lucky that the game was rained out against Sonny Gray. Garvin for Vanderbilt carved him up. Those are two guys that are going to be drafted in the first round. Palzone for Georgia, 8 innings. DJ Baxendale, who they probably will face in the second game of the SEC tournament, pitched a complete game against them. So against teams number ones, Florida hadn't done well. So, and I asked them before media, a couple days before the series started, you know, how big of a deal is it to beat Meyer, just to kind of get some confidence heading into the postseason that you can beat a number one's team, beat an ace.
Yeah, no,
and
sorry.
Sully totally brushed me off and was like, we're not worried about that now. We're just worried about Thursday night. And it's like, dude, you're going to win, you know, the likelihood is that you're going to win two games in this series. Kentucky doesn't have half the squad. They've won freaking two road games all season before they beat Florida on Friday. It's like,
They're going to win with Meyer.
Put some perspective in how you guys think you guys match up against Meyer. So obviously, come Friday night, not only does Hudson Randall, who I think is the best guy on the team to talk to. He's the only guy that gives true perspective. He's very rational in his responses. He mans up when he does well. He's there to talk. And when he doesn't do well, he's there to talk. And I find that extremely respectable and honorable, because there's several people that won't do that, and they're very protective of these players.
Right, regardless of how much they're coached up, you know. Randall still will come out and give his honest opinion.
And I respect Randall immensely for that. So he comes out. They get walloped. Randall does not pitch well. And he, you know, said after the game he was so disappointed.
I'm surprised you actually got him in for interviews.
He's the team ace. And he wanted to be in this position to clinch it for Florida, and he didn't show up. But at the same time, I mean, Florida's bullpen, basically O'Sullivan just led some of these other kids, Danny Gibson and these other freshmen, just threw them to the wolves.
It's like, oh, well, we're going to win. It's cool. I'll save my arms and just throw out the freshmen.
But Florida only scored one run. Meyer pitched 7 1/3 innings and just totally dominated. I mean, like, his breaking ball was nasty. And the crowd was getting pissed because the umpire had a widening strike zone. But still, they got totally dominated by this. So Sully was so pissed at his players. And he had, per the usual, when Florida gets their butt kicked, a team powwow. And I've never seen this many powwows for a non-high school sport. I mean, it totally just seems like high school to me. I could be immature in thinking that, but for whatever reason, they don't have these things in the dugout. Like, they have these tongue lashings in the clubhouse. They have these tongue lashings in the dugout for everybody to see.
Yeah,
but we're not allowed to get close enough
immediately
to hear
after the game.
Right. So it's like, it's all just, you know, conjecture to what they're actually talking about, because then they refuse to actually admit, what team meeting? It's like, I just saw you freaking have a team. What are you talking about? So Sully comes out and he is, you know, obviously going to be upset. I don't deny that. I mean, he's going to be very upset. His team just totally didn't show up on a game that was extremely crucial. And he got mad at one question somebody else asked, but he kind of was able to blow that off a little bit. And then I literally just asked, put into some perspective what you're going to say to Whitson, their Florida's heralded freshman who's going to pitch on Saturday. What are you going to tell him to make sure that he's not too overwhelmed by the pressure?
And this is a legitimate, legitimate question, without a doubt. This is an 18-year-old, 19-year-old kid, freshman, pitching in the season finale with the SEC championship on the line. Like, that is a legitimate question. Everybody I've talked to about the situation, that's a legitimate question. Everybody agrees.
And Sully, and I have to preface this, Sully and I have since, you know, we talked afterwards or the next day, and this has all been hashed out, but it was just kind of interesting to just kind of see how mad he was. So he flipped out on that question. And then I actually proceeded to interrupt him, I proceeded to interrupt him just to make sure that he understood where I was coming from, that, like, I'm asking, you know, are you going to say anything to make sure that this kid's not too hyped up, too amped up because of, you know, the situation? And then he listed that he's pitched in front of 12,000 people in Arkansas and 60, 70 scouts. And then the interview was cut off. I didn't even get to say, basically, that I would think that an SEC championship is bigger than all those moments.
Right.
But,
I mean, like you said earlier, all of this is you know, exacerbated by the heat of the moment and the situation.
Right.
As much as, you know, the next day, him apologizing and you know, realizing.
We had a good little chat. Yeah, we had a good little chat, and it was good. And we both kind of talked to each other where we came from. And, I mean, it was all good. I respect Sully for doing that. I think that was definitely a good thing for him and for me. I mean, it was good for both. It was a learning experience for me, and I think it was a good thing for him. But, yeah, I mean, in the end, Florida did win. Whitson, the next day, the pressure, whatever Sully did say to him, it worked.
Yeah,
you know, I don't know
right,
what he said.
Right, right.
But good for Sully, whatever he said. Whitson came out, threw five really good innings. He scattered a bunch of hits, but he pitched well. Didn't really actually even have his strikeout pitch working, but he had two big strikeouts with runners at first and third when the game was still close. And then Florida, just in the fourth inning, the floodgates just open, and they scored seven runs and hung a touchdown on Kentucky another inning, too. So it was an interesting final regular season game as they head to Hoover. They play tomorrow against Mississippi State. No starters or pitchers have been announced for either team. My guess is that Florida's going to throw out AP.
I think they're going to throw a penalty on us.
Yeah, it's kind of scary for Florida fans, I would assume, because AP has been not the old panda bear that they're used to seeing. And I don't know if we'll ever see him.
He's shown glimpses at times this year, though.
He's shown glimpses, but
it's also been against lesser competition.
Yeah, he's been marred by inconsistency. He hadn't faced an SEC team all season.
Right.
He did face Florida State a couple times, so I'll definitely, you know, I'll give him one. He never did really well, I guess. I'll at least, you know, tip my hat that he has faced, you know, one really good team. But the other big news for the baseball thing, I don't know if you guys heard this, it was just breaking news, Cam Washington officially is transferring.
Oh, well, who would have guessed?
Right, it's been rumored for a while. He actually left the team this week.
Really?
Earlier this week, yeah. Mr. Jason Leisure broke the story. Cam is from Palm Beach Post,
okay.
So it makes sense. So a little connection there.
Right.
Makes sense, too, because it was kind of funny. Jason, nice guy. Never been to – I think he's been to, like, three baseball games all season. But he asked – he came to, like, the preseason baseball media just to ask about Cam Washington and Cody Dent, both guys that hardly played and aren't really that good, so it's kind
but
of
Cam
funny.
Washington, I mean, he put in some good production when Bryson Smith was out with his suspension, right?
He did, and it's been interesting. And there's obviously some sort of you know, discord between he and Sully because he is far and above a better defensive center fielder than Bryson Smith, and so to at least he should be in a lot of these games as a defensive replacement, and he never is.
No, what do you think this says?
There.
I mean, Bryson Smith is senior, and, you know, he gets the DUI, gets suspended, but he doesn't get kicked off the team. Last season, who was it that got the DUI, got kicked off the team?
I think it was 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And that was some pitcher. That was before my time. I don't remember. I know that's been alluded to. It definitely is an interesting dynamic. Yeah, an interesting dynamic just for Florida looking forward is just their depth. They,
right.
Team depth, I mean, this season and beyond, basically third base is a black hole for Florida this season. I mean, it's three guys that, I mean, they have a freshman that has powers, has potential. But he's hurt he's come back from a knee injury. Moyer's hurt right now. Cody Dent is terrible. I mean, they don't know what they're going to do there. And then looking forward, this means next season, Tyler Thompson is going to be the only returning outfielder to the Gators, which that is kind of scary because Tyler Thompson does one or two things. He hits a home run, one out of 30 at bats, or he strikes out. I mean, literally, that guy can't hit a breaking ball to save his life. So
they're losing Piggott?
Piggott's going to go pro. That would be my guess here is that Piggott, I mean, he's a outstanding athlete, has a prototype baseball body, and has put up a good season.
He's not a top 10 round draft pick, do you think?
Oh, he'll be top 15. He'll definitely go. And Tucker will be top.
Tucker will go in the first five rounds, I believe.
Yes, I would say 4 to 6. Yeah. And I think Pickett will go in 10, okay. Around 10. Yeah, okay. And Pickett will be gone. Florida's going to lose a lot of people. Mirande, Discofani, all these guys, they're all gone. So it's going to be interesting, but, I mean, Sullivan brings...
Yeah,
brings in.
If there's one thing he can do, that's Sully.
Yeah, Sully's a master recruiter. The dude knows how to recruit. Right. I mean, they have this sophomore class has the potential to be kind of like the senior class that softball is rolling out right now. You know, the next wave of baseball players.
Isn't there an amazing class coming in for lacrosse as well, Booth?
Yeah, the lacrosse team. They have 3 players out of the top 25, I think it is right now, for ESPN Rise. So, and the word is that one of the girls is going to come in and contribute right away in the midfield. Of course, Florida this season was one of the least substituted teams that they played. They had a really small rotation of players. Okay. Only 3 or 4 players off the bench would play. Whereas you see these like really experienced deep teams like Northwestern and Duke and Stanford, and they're bringing all their underclassmen, all these their senior waves like off the bench, you know, to keep players fresh. But you know, Florida athletically, I don't know if they just thought that wasn't an issue or if they don't trust some of their younger players yet to go in, you know, substituting a whole wave of freshmen. But that seems like at times that was a concern. A couple games there was a lot of turnovers late, especially and a lot of games in the second half they gave up leads.
What happened this weekend?
Yeah, the season finale, right? Weekend. It was something like that. They gave it up at the end.
So yeah, well, it was the first half that it dug them in a hole. And they started to come back. They got their draw control problem, you know, under wraps, so to speak, and made a couple changes there. And they were up 9-8 with, I believe, 17 minutes left in the game. And then Duke, you know, who was exhausted at that point. They were tired from running around with the Gators.
Right. Me and Holt were right next door at the softball stadium. It was blazing that day.
Yeah, it was cool. And that's the thing, like Florida, none of these girls who are playing, none of them are native Floridians. They've been in this weather for 2 years, and so to a certain extent, they are used to it, but they still hate playing in the 90-degree weather. Like, they don't revel in it. They don't think it's that much of a home advantage, but they know it's gonna stink for the other team more than it is for them. So, yeah, at that point in the game, Duke was exhausted. They said after the game, their coach, they were gassed. And, you know, definitely a lot of the crowd, they were getting restless because Duke started stalling a lot. There was a couple yellow cards in the second half. So, of course, there's no shot clock in women's lacrosse like there is for men's, where they've got to get, you know, they've got to end the possession. So they can hold on to it as long as they can keep the ball. And and Duke just
sounds
started.
Exhilarating.
Yeah, it wasn't for a long stretch in the second half. It was ugly, boring lacrosse, and the only thing that kept it interesting was because of how big of a game it was. You know, it was a Final Four berth was on the line, and anything, you know, Florida or Duke at this point, with how good these teams have been this season, is going to be a big deal. So there was still a lot of tension. But yeah, it was tough watching Duke sit through 3-minute possessions where they're just passing it around, you know, 30 yards, you know, away from the goal, and they have zero intention of running their offense.
But it ended up working out for them, right?
Yeah, because at the end of those, at the end of both of those possessions, when they scored, they went on a 5-0 run, but 3 of those goals were, you know, they were kind of
empty
cheap goals
almost,
where, yeah, it was empty netters. Florida was desperate with about 2-3 minutes left. So it was really a 10-9 loss for Florida in all actuality. And those, at the end of both of those possessions, you know, Duke showed why having experience in women's lacrosse you know, such a help. Whereas in other sports, I think you can get away with having pure talent at that stage in the game. Duke was able to settle down and actually run their offense.
But that brings us to, you know, I think, which is the most interesting point about this lacrosse team. So they're only in their second year, and they're, you know, playing with the best teams in the country, and they return all 27 players. There's only one junior on this team, folks. I mean, the whole team is made up of sophomores and freshmen, right?
Yeah, there's one junior on the team who transferred, and she's coming off the bench. She's not, you know, late in the season, she really lost her, you know, her name's Caroline Cochran, and she's a great midfielder, but she's not a scoring threat. And so she's, you know, she's really good at, you know, keeping things under control, but she's definitely, she's not a superstar. She wasn't in the top 10 in scoring this season. So looking forward for the team, they're going to have all of these players. And of course, they lost five players last offseason to transfer after a year because, you know, a lot of people weren't getting playing time. There was a lot of girls in one class. And now you're adding seven more players.
Well, that's going to be kind of interesting because O'Leary just has spoken like glowingly about the team chemistry and the unity and how, you know, and she does seem like one of the bright young stars for coaches on this campus. I mean, it seems like she's going to win a national championship or at least has a chance to bring one to Florida in the next couple of years.
Yeah, you say bright young star because she's relatively still unknown in this era. But she's a Hall of Fame lacrosse player. You know, everybody else around the country knows who Amanda O'Leary is, and Kevin O'Leary, her husband, who's a college lacrosse ref, and he played a lot too, and he's extremely well respected. So the family is, you know, they're kind of lacrosse royalty.
And don't they have two assistant coaches that are just recent graduates that from their playing days?
Well, the chick from Maryland is like on the USA team.
Two of the best players in the world, right?
Caitlin McFadden last year won the Touraton, which is the equivalent to the, you know, the Heisman or the Naismith. And I guess, you know, if you could only imagine, you know, if Tim Tebow, after he won the Heisman, graduated and started coaching somewhere else other than Florida. And the really cool thing was, you know, Florida would have won, and I say would have won, but they would have gotten to play Maryland in the next round, who is Caitlin McFadden, who won that award. That was her old team last year. And so Florida would have, like
80%
of
these players are from
Maryland. They're from Maryland.
Yeah, that's like the Northeast is the lacrosse area, right? I mean, there's not girls down in Florida that are, you know, you're not doing much recruiting down in Florida for the lacrosse team, is basically what I'm saying.
just in this last decade, women's lacrosse and men's lacrosse has become an FHS, AA, you know, sanctioned sport. So there's there's
way too many letters.
there's very little recruiting that comes out of Florida. I know they have two Florida players on the roster right now, and they're going to add another one next year. But they're all from Vero Beach or Atlantis University, but high school. So there's very few competitive teams in Florida that can really supply players. But you look at Jacksonville as well, and they're really under the radar because Florida beat up on them earlier in the season, and even myself, I kind of pushed them aside. I was like, they are the only other women's lacrosse team in the state, but they're not too much of a threat. They put together a great season. They almost became another Florida team that made it to the women's lacrosse tournament. They lost their automatic bid in their conference tournament to a team that they had previously beaten by 7 goals earlier in the year. So next year, and Jacksonville's not losing much either because they're a brand new program just like Florida.
That reminds me a lot about the Jacksonville University softball team, actually, that was in the same regional with UCLA and Florida. I was about to say, I'm from Jacksonville, unabashed homer on this regard. The JU Dolphins bringing it home right there.
I
went up to the JU's head coach after they were eliminated on Saturday and told Amanda Leodak that I was thoroughly impressed. When I saw that it was Bethune-Cookman, Jacksonville, and then UCLA in Florida, you know? You're like, okay, sweet. JU and BCC will lose their first two games. This will be a nice, easy weekend.
Whipping boys.
Right. Not at all. JU put it together. They two-hit UCLA in the first game. Sarah Seigers two-hit them. And the only two hits were from Andrea Harrison, the girl we were talking about earlier that raked all weekend. She no-hit the rest of UCLA's roster. Defending national champions, no-hit them. I mean, and if it wasn't for two kind of silly errors in the field, they probably would have won that game. So, I mean, I was really impressed with JU, and I really think that they've got, you know, a bright future ahead, kind of like you're talking about in lacrosse.
They led the country in scoring this year with 16 goals, which was, you know, that was another thing. Midway through the season, you're looking through these stat lines, and granted, they didn't play in an ultra-competitive conference. No, nobody in their conference was ranked, but still, to be where they are with Florida with, you know, not even a comparable amount of funding. They play in a, you know, on a field next to their football
stadium. Right,
went
to their stadium. I encourage people,
like,
if you can go to JU's campus, please go.
No press box, you know, not to rag on it, because they are, you know, they have so many sports.
Just quick note, Florida has the nicest facility.
Yeah,
Well,
yeah.
JU's a private
Thanks,
school
Jeremy
also.
Foley.
I mean, they don't have much funding, and they don't have a privatized University Athletic Association with
right.
a limited budget that's, you
yeah,
know, able to donate millions to the, the Scholastic program.
A $15 million lacrosse facility.
Yeah,
that's something that, you know, it's not seen, especially for women's lacrosse. Johns Hopkins is building one currently. That's a $10 million facility, but it's for their men's and women's team. And men's draws a ton of players.
Right, and they're one of
people.
The most historical programs
think,
for lacrosse,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and they charge admission.
And that's
as
the
well.
First one of the first things anybody that I've ever heard talk about Florida lacrosse is, I cannot believe the facility that they have. I mean,
yeah.
I hadn't seen it in person until the other day. I walked by when we were going to the softball stadium, and I was blown away. It's gorgeous.
Jeremy Foley has done a lot of good things for this university, and that is, I mean, because it sounds like tons more fans. It's progressively gotten, you know, more and more fans are going to these games, and I think it has the potential to be a big draw, like women's soccer, that, like, you know, people want to go and take their kids to, you know, see, especially with the different budding programs around
but that's
town,
in
with high school and that kind
it's
of stuff.
It's one of those
people in Gainesville love Florida, and,
yeah, exactly.
and they will go out and support in force if that program is winning.
Oh, absolutely! And Foley brought lacrosse because he is a Northerner and loves lacrosse, and it was a Jeremy Foley goal was to get a lacrosse program at Florida, and he obviously has been very successful in doing so. Found a hell of a coach, and that is
second
year,
almost one of the
well.
Best teams.
Yeah, I mean, at the beginning of the season, they had really mediocre numbers in for their games. I mean, 400, 500 people in a 1500, you know,
seat stadium.
Yeah, and you know, especially, I guess, the...
All right, y'all, we're going to talk a little bit of pro sports. We got some hockey fans in here. A lot of great action going on in the NBA playoffs. The lockout crap is still going on. So we're pitting a Bruins fan versus a Lightning fan, though. It's been a hell of a series. We're going to love duke it out here. Booth, what you got?
Okay, so first of all, how long do you think that 90% of the fans in Tampa Bay watched a game this season before the playoffs started?
Well,
going right in.
Square in the mouth right when they start.
No, because I don't get how you can have this team, and they were such a surprise this season. You know, they have a new owner there, rejuvenated. They're going to have new logo, uniforms, the whole deal. They've reinvented themselves this season and heading into next season. And they aren't embraced until like the third round of the playoffs when there are a couple games from the Stanley Cup. Now everybody lies, it's our city, our team type of thing.
That's what you're talking about. Simple. I mean, it's hockey in Tampa. I mean, nobody's ever played it. Nobody's ever. It's. I mean, are you comparing Boston to Tampa right now? First of all, the only reason why the Lightning are able to even stay in Tampa is because they're the only team in Tampa that plays downtown, which allows them to get corporate season tickets. So even when the stadium looks empty during the regular season, they actually do have average attendance numbers for the NHL. They have no fan support.
Yeah, so yeah, I don't know, let's put this in a relative say here. Does Tampa have good attendance for the Rays? No.
No.
But does Tampa have good attendance for the Bucks?
Tampa
no.
Bay has won.
When the Bucks are good,
the Bucks
have won. The Bucks won a Super Bowl,
and they
had the worst attendance in the league last year.
9 years removed from a Super Bowl.
but before that, before they hit rock bottom, they were still, after they won their Super Bowl, they were incredibly well supported.
They were still a great football team last year. They almost won 11 games.
Yeah, but they were having a resurgence, though. They were
bad. We're getting off topic. Let's go back to your hockey.
Don't get me started on Tampa attendance. It'll just get ugly and mean. All right.
But how long do you think that the Lightning can stay in contention in the future, though? Can they keep their players like LeCavalier and Stamkos in the future there when a franchise like the Thrashers, who throughout the season, you know, isn't as well supported like the Lightning is being moved to Winnipeg?
I mean, other than Stamkos,
they're getting stolen.
They're getting stolen to Winnipeg.
I mean, how much of that was Nashville not, you know, being able to support a team, and Winnipeg really needing a team back? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that's Canada. That's
there was always just
completely
about the Phoenix
Coyotes conversation.
The Thrashers thing is such a freaking, like it's just a monstrosity what they're doing. I understand that Atlanta, those fans haven't supported it the way they should, but who's going to support a team when, you know, 9 out of 10 years they haven't made the playoffs?
Mm-hmm.
In hockey, everybody makes the freaking playoffs. It's like you have to be a freaking like the Stepford stepchild to not make the playoff in hockey. But still, that team is not going bankrupt. That team is still in the red. And the NHL bailed out.
They had a good
black,
start to the season,
and they
too.
Had a good start. And the NHL bailed out Phoenix, gave them $60 million, and they won't even help out Atlanta. Just find new owners. All the Atlanta owners want to do is sell the team, and they won't find somebody to sell the team to keep them into Atlanta. I mean, it's such a monster.
Well, it's all about the money. It's the same thing in basketball where, you know, the NBA bought the Hornets, but they don't want to give any support to Sacramento.
Right. Well, that's because the Maloof brothers screwed their own coach. Atlanta's not going to be have lost two NHL teams.
Yeah.
And the Flames were good. That's what's hilarious. The Flames were actually good. But anyway, this is way too much on hockey. I mean, really, if Boston wins another Stanley Cup, if they just win another championship in anything, I'm going to go ape crap. I mean,
to be fair, though, the Bruins haven't been truly good or even back on the map for 20 years.
Hates that owner.
But yeah, they've had horrible management, you know, over the years where they've lost, you know, tremendous players. They've drafted awful until now. They've really... You know, they picked up a guy. Tyler Seguin is looking like a great pickup that they had in the draft. He's a 18, 19-year-old kid who scored in, you know, before last night, 3 straight playoff games. You know, so it's, either way this series shakes out, the winner probably loses to Vancouver in the Stanley Cup because it's moved. They're the best team here.
In defense of Tampa hockey real quick, I don't know if it's just my personality or what, but I kind of take pride in the fact that there are a bunch of people in Boston and Canada that are, like, completely passionate about their hockey team. And here's this little team from Tampa that nobody really cares about.
Yeah.
Like, I enjoy seeing, like, when Tampa beat Calgary, I enjoyed seeing Calgary fans get so pissed off because they cared so much about this team. And here's all these Tampa fans that just kind of sweep in, you know, the last couple of weeks of the regular season and through the playoffs, and it's comical to me. I don't know. I mean, I realize there's this whole standards of hockey, where if you're not from Canada, you're not one of the original six or whatever the hell it is.
I don't believe, though, you know, in this era, a team like necessarily playing down south or in warm weather, you know, is historically going to make them a bad team, though. You know, it's not
like you're playing outside in the weather.
Yeah, and it's not like these players are, most of them are even from the United States or anything like
that. Well, and another thing with just whether it's Tampa, Miami, I mean, the Heat. People don't go to the Heat games.
Right.
You know why? Because they have better things to do.
It's not the spot to be seen until the playoffs.
Right,
and then
better things
the playoffs is the spot to be seen, and it's sold out, and everybody, oh, I want to go to the Heat game. But, you know, it's the same situation. You've got the Bruins, the, you know, historical, respected franchise. It's kind of comparable to the Bulls. But then it's a flip-flop because the Bulls are kind of, you know, trying to fight to take it from the Heat. You've got the two of the best players and maybe three of the best players. I hate Chris Bostrich, just putting it out there for the record. He's terrible. But, yeah, I mean, it's the same type of thing. You've got, you know, a heralded, respected franchise like the Bulls trying to take it from the Heat.
It's a little strange when you're watching this Heat Bulls series too, I feel like, because, you know, the Bulls are this team trying to, you know, knock off the Heat. But when I watch these games that are in Chicago, maybe it's just because I grew up during the whole Jordan thing and all that stuff, but you're watching these games, like, it just feels right to see Chicago, like, excited about the playoffs and doing well. And, you know, seeing the United Center going wild is just like, it feels right after we've had all these years of watching the Spurs and teams like that, you know. It just seems more fitting for me.
Another Spurs hater in the house. Another Spurs hater. But people don't like that boring brand of basketball where teams just win. No, it is fun. And the Bulls have actually, last couple seasons, when, I mean, with Noah and with Lou Alding and Ben Gordon and those guys,
well,
a couple
really
years ago, when they had those insane games, those triple overtime games against the Celtics, like, those were some fun. And Noah had that, like, steal and dunk on Pierce. I mean, so they definitely, it's good to see the Bulls back. And I definitely agree. Nowitzki last night was nasty. I recorded the game because I was in the office and I only watched the fourth quarter and the overtime just because of how he was ridiculous. Like, that guy, he's got to be the top five guys in the league right now.
Oh,
and
no doubt.
And he's
top 15 of all time, in my opinion.
Yeah, probably. I mean, his numbers, Bill Simmons did something not that long ago about his numbers, as scary it is for Simmons to admit, his numbers are as good, if not better, than, like, Bird's.
Right, that's the comparison for me. And, I mean, the man is just unguardable.
Yeah,
you can't do anything to a man that can drive the hole, shoot the three, hit the fadeaway over anybody, over another seven-footer. He's got one of the prettiest jump shots in the game.
How can you defend a seven-footer fading away?
He can come off the pick and roll. He can do anything. He plays pretty good defense, too. You know, I mean, like, Dirk Nowitzki is just amazing. But back to the Bulls for a second. I mean, the only thing that's kind of tarnished this whole series is Joakim Noah's little outburst the other night. I mean...
Yeah,
what
I mean,
did you think about that?
That was definitely interesting. I think his he and Lou Alding's response, obviously, there seems to be some sort of line where we've accepted that fans can pay for a ticket and they're allowed to say whatever they want. You know, that's it's all in the game, that they can say whatever they want. No, you know, no matter how foul or nasty or whatever it is, but if a player responds. And I'm not saying what he said was, you know, was right. What he said was obviously wrong. But if a player responds, then because they're famous and because they're on camera, they're not, you know, they're the ones that are, you know, having to pay the price. When literally, you know, I can buy a ticket and say whatever the hell I want, but there should be some sort of line. And say to you,
I respect that argument completely. But when you're getting paid, you know, seven figures to play a game, you kind of got to be cognizant of the fact that you can't be cussing and saying, you know, degenerate, you know, terms like that on television.
Completely agree. And part of it is just that because there's so many cameras now. They can catch everything.
Yeah.
Like 10 years ago, they weren't catching half the stuff that, you know, Derek Coleman and these other guys. And Barkley was freaking yelling in the crowd. And I'm the biggest. I've been on this podcast so many times and pimped out Charles Barkley because he's like one of my favorite guys, and he has said some of the nastiest things to fans.
No doubt.
And you know, and like It wasn't as big of a deal back then.
People that are blind can read lips now. And you know what I mean, with HD.
I do think that.
You have proof of that?
Yes.
I do think that the NBA made a good decision of finding him half of what they fined Kobe, because it was a completely different situation. Kobe said that to an official, like
no one
said anything to him to make him that bad. Yeah, he was just he was antagonized because the official made a poor call or whatever. See, he said that someone said something to Noah to light him off. So I do agree with the fine.
Do you think that was the entirety of why the fine was doubled for Kobe, or do you think there was any part of that that's Kobe that said it, and Noah's a great player, but he's Noah is not Kobe.
No, because I actually think sometimes the NBA kind of uses backward logic for a lot of their stuff, that I actually think they're more likely to suspend and punish guys that are more crazy and outlandish like Noah and Artest and these guys than they ever are to fine and penalize the best of the best and the best and the brightest.
Yeah, I mean, I was a little bit surprised that the fine was half. I almost thought it would be the same, if not more, because it was so close in sequence to Kobe's event. You know what I mean? Like, the people that stand up for this type of stuff are not taking it anymore. You know, like, they're going to be out there, and they've got their connections in the media, and I just thought it was going to be a bigger deal in terms of money and fine than it ended up being.
Well, it's interesting timing too, because,
and it's also the playoffs, you know.
Yeah, interesting timing too, because Rick Welts, who is a high guy in the NBA for 20 years, he created the NBA, all the NBA All-Star festivities, ran the Supersonics, then was David Stern's right-hand man for like 15 years, and now he runs the Suns. He just recently came out and is one of the biggest high-profile homosexuals, you know, in sports today. And it's an incredible story that he just came out. And he came out, like, officially told Stern the day
before. Yeah, that was so random.
Before Kobe said his thing to the official, and now he just came out nationally 2 weeks ago. And so it's like funny how this is all, so it's just put the NBA on another, you know, Grant Hill and Dudley and Steve Nash.
The ad campaign.
And like the stuff that's going on and the hockey, Sean Avery. All
right, guys, that's going to wrap up our podcast this week. Sorry, we had a couple technical difficulties in our first recording of the show. But don't worry, it'll be all good next week. Tune back in. We're going to have our own little spin on the 1Ds and the Pierres, or the majors and the 1Ds, excuse me. And we're also going to have great coverage this weekend on the website of all the Gator sports taking on Florida in the SEC tournament, the Gators baseball team in the SEC tournament, all the other sports going on in NCAAs. Make sure you check that out. Also check out our Facebook page. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and follow us on Twitter at Alligator Sports. Thanks.